Greetings and welcome. There's seats sprinkled out throughout, still plenty along that wall, and a few up here if you're brave and want to come into the front. Great. My name is Antoinette Burton. I'm a professor of history here at the University of Illinois and director of the Humanities Research Institute. HRI is honored to be the home of InterSeminars, which many of you will know is a multi-year experiment in graduate education funded in part by the Mellon Foundation. And I'm excited to welcome you to the first public event of the third InterSeminars project to take root in Illinois under the guiding theme, Collisions Across Color Lines, Reconsidering Races and Movements and Epistemes in the Americas. The goal of the InterSeminars initiative is to build communities of inquiry among graduate students and faculty here at Illinois around emerging research directions in the interdisciplinary humanities and arts. This cohort, designed at the outset by a group of interdisciplinary scholars, faculty conveners, Professors Eric McDuffie, Gilberto Rosas, and Gisela Sin, began last summer in an intensive immersive experience with 9 graduate students in the humanities and arts from across the university. Yasmin Adams, Grace Bay, Jose Diaz, Omar Hernandez, Samantha Jones, Nick Owens, Anna Pei, Leonardo Ventura, and Tuma Zaghloul, who are all in the process of collaborating in the coursework and broader goals of the project. If we could just have a round of applause for that third InterSeminars group. This afternoon is the beginning of what will be a series of compelling events this year. Under the invitation to join the problem space of collisions across color lines, which is designed to explore the collisions between lived experiences of race and racism, their relation with the movement of people, ideas, and revolutionary imaginaries that span the hemisphere, and the structures within which knowledge is produced and reproduced. The conveners envision collisions as a productive lens for critically exploring how activists, artists, and other intellectuals reckon with the regional epistemes and remaking of race and racism as they relate to anti-blackness, anti-indigeneity, the vexed and complicated position of other impoverished and racial mestizo or other brown communities, particularly migrants and those otherwise crossing international boundaries, and related formations of oppression, gender, and sexuality foremost among them. I know we're all eager to get to the main event, but before we do, InterSeminars convener Professor Sin will read a land acknowledgement, and then Professor McDuffie will introduce Professor Horn. So cascading introductions, but all really important. So, Gisela.
Good afternoon. I'm Gisela Sin, and I'm one of the conveners of this third InterSeminars. And I would like to begin today by recognizing and acknowledging that we are on the lands of the Peoria, Kaskaskia, Piankashaw, Wea, Miami, Maskoutin, Odawa, Sauk, Meskwaki, Kickapoo, Potawatomi, Ojibwe, and Chickasaw nations. These lands were the traditional territory of these native nations prior to their forced removal. These lands continue to carry the stories of these nations and their struggles for survival and identity. As a land-grant institution, the University of Illinois has a particular responsibility to acknowledge the peoples of these lands, as well as the histories of dispossession that have allowed for the growth of this institution for the past 150 years. We are also obligated to reflect on and actively address these histories and the role that this university has played in shaping them. This acknowledgement and the centering of Native peoples is a start as we move forward for the next 150 years. Thank you. Eric?
Thank you, Dr. Sin. Good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome. My name is Eric McDuffie. I am an associate professor of African American Studies and History at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. On behalf of my inner seminar co-conveners, Professor Gilberto Rosas, Gisela Sin, and graduate fellows Jasmine Adams, Grace Bay, Jose Diaz, Omar Hernandez, Samantha Jones, Nick Owens, Leonardo Ventura, and Tuma Zanklu. It is my sincere pleasure to welcome you to this afternoon's talk by Dr. Gerald Horn. Unfortunately, Dr. Rosas is unable to attend today's talk. Before I introduce Dr. Horn, I would like to acknowledge that our inner seminar and today's talk would be impossible without the incredible support from HRI. Thank you, Professors Antoinette Burton, Siobhan Somerville, Jenny Davis, and Nancy Castro, and the entire HRI staff for your support, guidance, and patience. We very much look forward to working with you over the next 12 months. Now to the introduction of today's speaker. For many of us in the room, Dr. Gerald Horn needs no introduction. However, for those of you who are unfamiliar with him and his work, here goes. Dr. Horn holds the Moores Professorship of History and African-American Studies at the University of Houston, Houston, Texas. His research, grounded in history, African-American studies, Africana studies, and African studies, has addressed issues of racism and a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. He has also written extensively about the film industry, sports, and culture. Dr. Horn received his PhD in history from Columbia University and his JD from the University of California, Berkeley, and his BA from Princeton University. He has held faculty and fellowship positions at St. Lawrence College, the University of California, Columbia University, University of North Carolina, University of Hong Kong, and University of Zimbabwe, among other institutions. A fellow Midwesterner. Yes, he is. He grew up in Jim Crow era St. Louis, Missouri, and he spent considerable time as a young person in East St. Louis, Illinois, among other places across the Prairie State. Dr. Horn is the author of more than 50 books and 100 scholarly articles and reviews. He has published on average 2 to 3 books a year for more than 20 years. Some of his latest books include, and I didn't go to the gym, but this will work for today, just in terms of its weight. Some of his latest books include The Counter-Revolution of 1836, Texas Slavery and Jim Crow and the Roots of U.S. Fascism, 2022. I Dare Say, a Gerald Horn Reader, 2024. And Armed Struggle, Panthers and Communists, Black Nationalists and Liberals in Southern California through the 60s and 70s, 2024. His next book projects include a study of slavery in Washington, D.C. and slavery in North Africa. In addition to his academic publications, he is a regular guest on countless Black radical and progressive podcasts and media outlets in the United States and around the world, including the Activist News Network, which features a weekly international hour titled Around the Horn. If I may, and I know Dr. Horn is very humble, but I will say this, Dr. Horn, and this is not an understatement, Dr. Horn is one of the preeminent Black historians of our time and one of the tallest trees in our forest. His work is rooted in the Black radical intellectual tradition of W.E.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, Claudia Jones, S. Lando Robeson, Shirley Graham Du Bois, William L. Patterson, Louise Thompson Patterson, and Alpheus Hunton. And as some of you know, Dr. Horn has written biographies on W.E.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, Shirley Graham Du Bois, and William L. Patterson. Informed by these activist intellectuals and Dr. Horn's own lived experiences in participating in Black radical formations in the late 1960s and early 70s, and his leadership in the National Conference of Black Lawyers in the 1970s, and the anti-apartheid movement in the 1980s. His work offers powerful and original analyses of white supremacy, capitalism, slavery, settler colonialism, labor, whiteness, genocide, heteropatriarchy, imperialism, opposition, and resistance in the making of the modern world. Even more, at a moment when colleges and universities across the United States are suppressing, surveilling, and silencing students and their allies in protests against troubling events across the Middle East, Dr. Horn is unapologetic and vocal in speaking out against US and Western imperialism in Africa and elsewhere, Zionism, and the genocide in Gaza, and spiraling violence in the occupied West Bank, among countless other places. Indeed, his work embodies the motto of African American studies, academic excellence and social responsibility, and the demand by the Nigerian British transnational feminist scholar Amina Mama that scholarship on Africa must be committed to countering global hegemonies and to advancing African liberation. One last point. Dr. Horn's work, and surely his talk today, contains important lessons, especially for students, but for all of us. That is the importance of being informed. The importance of being informed and in recognizing how the local and global are inextricably connected, even when these connections may not be apparent. Dr. Horn is a consummate reader of books and newspapers. The man, the brother, reads like a maniac. I will share very briefly with you two examples that speak to this point. I will never forget seeing Dr. Horn reading stacks of newspapers. I mean, stacks of newspapers in the lobby of a hotel at the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. It's almost, I dare say, to borrow his expression, you expect to see Dr. Horn holding court in the library of a conference, again, with stacks of newspapers from across the world. And I should also note that yesterday he sent HRI an email requesting or asking where he could purchase copies of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal near campus. After I picked him up from the airport and we had a great conversation, we were talking politics, this and that. And then he said out of the blue, did you get me or will you be able to get me copies of the New York Times and Wall Street Journal? And Omar, you took care of that, right, brother? All right, fantastic. So that said, I could go on and on and on, but I'll stop. The title of today's talk is Armed Struggle, Reflections on U.S. History Through My Latest Book. Without further ado, I dare say, Dr. Gerald Horn.
Well, thank you for that introduction. First of all, I'd like to thank the Humanities Research Institute and their exceedingly competent staff, and especially Professor McDuffie for arranging my visit. We all look forward to the imminent publication of his field-defining book on the Garvey Movement, soon to be published by Duke. Second, in lieu of a land acknowledgement, already given quite well, I would like to congratulate those on the forefront of the struggle concerning the so-called Fighting Illini mascot. I have no doubt you will prevail. And I say this in part because I grew up not far from here. As a youth, I not only was a frequent visitor in East St. Louis, or East Boogie, as we termed it, but also a visitor to the mounds of Cahokia, an urban conurbation whose memory has yet to be extirpated, and also gives us strength to recognize that the indigenous will ultimately attain justice. Speaking of Central Illinois, allow me to mention that in a previously published book of mine, Facing the Rising Sun, I pointed out that the headquarters for pro-Tokyo sentiment in Black America pre-1945 was precisely in the region heading eastward from St. Louis to the Indiana border. Indeed, in November 1942, as the fate of World War II had yet to be settled, Black Americans in this vicinity were drilling in uniform and armed, expecting to join a Japanese invasion of North America. This leads to two wider points. Because of the often forbidding correlation of forces that Black Americans have had to face, this necessitated reliance on external forces, such as that aforementioned Tokyo example, not to mention the Allied point that the enemies of Washington were not necessarily our enemies, too, a lesson too often forgotten today. And second, as with most histories, I do not think the last word has been written on pro-Tokyo sentiment amongst Black Midwesterners, a useful topic for one of our graduate students to explore in local sources here. Speaking of Central Illinois, although my talk does not address this frontally, my body of work tends to validate the perception that slayings of those like Sonia Massey in Springfield, Illinois, and Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, Africans slain at the hands of officers of the state is hardly accidental, but flows inevitably from the anti-blackness that accompanied the construction of slavery and white supremacy, and likewise will be circumscribed ultimately when opponents of this carnage organize more adroitly in the international community. Indeed, Sonia Massey, along with recently ousted Congresswoman Cori Bush of St. Louis, illustrate two major points that emerge, at least from my body of work, if not from the African-American experience writ large. That is to say, Massey's murder illustrates the profound anti-blackness that not only inherited in enslavement, but then was turbocharged further when this most valuable investment and the bodies of Africans was expropriated without compensation. Then propelled further when in the 20th century, Africans like Paul Robeson emerged as the face of socialism, too thought to involve expropriation of property without compensation, which then went on to undergird anti-communism, leading to wars in Korea, Vietnam, elsewhere, but also a disastrous anti-Sovietism that set the stage, ironically, for the rise of China, alluded to below. While this was unfolding, as the defeat of Cori Bush suggests, the two ideological pillars of Black America, the semicolon in that title is doing a lot of work, by the way. The two ideological pillars of Black America, Black nationalism and liberalism, as reflected in the NAACP, the Congressional Black Caucus, and some of your unmentioned neighbors due north in Chicago, have been remarkably inconsistent, if not quiet, in confronting global challenges, be it in Ukraine, China, the crisis in Zimbabwe, the crisis in Venezuela, the Alliance of Sahel States, the China-Africa Summit, the Egypt-Ethiopia crisis, the crisis of Nippon Steel. I mean, I could go on for the next 45 minutes in that vein. Ironically, the quiescence of dominant Black sentiment in foreign policy has empowered the hawks in the Democratic Party, allowing Trumpistas to pose as anti-war, just as the neo-Nazi alternative for Germany just did successfully in the recent Federal Republic of Germany elections. We are undergoing a major stress test as we speak, as the man who received 75 million votes in 2020 has morphed from calling his major opponent laughing Kamala to lying Kamala before lighting on comrade Kamala, which is the label he will seemingly adhere to, bringing echoes of this oft-neglected tie between anti-Blackness and anti-communism. In that vein, I would also like to salute the University of Illinois Press, with whom I published two books. I'd be remiss if I did not mention my local connection, a leading publisher with whom I look forward to collaborations in the future. Now, with that introduction, let me now provide my reflections. And this is really from the opening page of this book. It was June 1971 in Algiers, the intriguing Mediterranean city in North Africa, featuring a plethora of whitewashed buildings, then the major site of the major international legation of the Black Panther Party headquartered in California. It was in Algeria where party leaders Kathleen Neal Cleaver and Donald Cox were to be found conferring with a diplomat from the embassy of then socialist Czechoslovakia. The readout was explicit. The US militants were seeking, quote, Model 61 automatic machine pistols, ideally suited to the conditions of our struggle in the urban areas, unquote. Also desired were, quote, silencers, unquote. These Panthers had been, quote, informed, unquote, that the diplomats, quote, government supported the liberation struggles of all peoples, unquote, so why not back those in the citadel of imperialism? They were told by the diplomats that, quote, they would do whatever they could to aid us, unquote. Fellow exile Panther Pete O'Neill, originally from Kansas City, recalled that, quote, the North Vietnamese embassy, unquote, in Algiers, quote, also gave us money and some guns, unquote. Certainly the Panthers were well armed. According to then Panther leader Elaine Brown, by the 1970s in the vicinity of Oakland, they had, quote, literally thousands of weapons, large numbers of AR-18 and AR-18 short automatic rifles, .308 scope rifles, 30-30 Winchesters, 375 Magnum, 30 Calendar Garands, M15s and M16s, submachine guns, M59 Santa Fe Troopers, anti-tank guns, innumerable shotguns, grenade launchers, suitcases, trunk loads, closets full of pistols, boxes and boxes of ammunition, crossbows and arrows, grenades, unquote. And of course, it was also suggested that they could get tanks if need be. She added that by, quote, by August 1974, her party was, quote, the only armed revolutionary organization operating, unquote, in the United States, unquote. By then, she said the Southern California chapter, warehouse large arsenals, and, quote, was completely underground, unquote. This riveting development was partially a product of a peculiar culture of the United States, fueled by the notorious Second Amendment to the US Constitution, as detailed by Andrew McKevitt in his UNC Press book, Gun Country. Post 1945, the United States became home to nearly half of all civilian-owned firearms in the world. There were more weapons than citizens. As the Panthers began to get their hands on these guns, this led to the pioneering 1968 Gun Control Act. But as they fade into the sunset in the 1970s, this presumed incongruity with the fabled Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution lapsed into oblivion accordingly. The foregoing provides a taste of this book, which is at least premised partially on a number of my previous books. For example, in recent years, I've published two books concerning settler colonialism in North America in the 16th and 17th centuries. This term, settler colonialism, has barged its way into the U.S. vocabulary in light of the heroic campus protests of 2024 concerning war crimes and U.S. support for same in historic Palestine. Inevitably, unless we seek to normalize the invasion and genocide in North America in recent centuries, we must begin applying this descriptor, settler colonialism, to what is now the United States of America. Parenthetically, a premier collection on this fraught topic, edited by a Pulitzer Prize winner, by its own description, focuses on European colonial projects in Africa, Algiers, South Africa, and expansionist efforts by the Japanese and Korea and Manchuria to the Germans and Poland, and to the historical trajectory of Israel-Palestine. But conspicuously missing is the heavyweight champion of settler colonialism, speaking of the USA. This is unfortunate, for in terms of seeking to explicate why in the late 20th century Black Americans were dickering in Algiers for arms, one has to understand what a leading Black communist, the burly Black California stevedore Roscoe Proctor, enunciated as these events were unfolding. There was reason to suspect that the descendants of the unpaid sector of the working class, speaking of the enslaved, did not have confidence in the bulk of this class, as evidence, for example, in votes for races for president of Jim Crow Governor George Wallace of Alabama, not to mention the post-1965 defection pursuant to the Voting Rights Act of too many Euro-American workers to the Republican Party and to conservatism, especially in the South, where, for example, this party routinely receives 80% plus of the vote, culminating in an unhealthy majority in Louisiana, voting for a Klansman and a Nazi, David Duke, for governor of Louisiana in 1991, coincidentally, as the socialist camp was imploding. Of course, their existence had helped to pressure the United States to a degree towards desegregation, as is exemplified not only in work that I've done, but the work of scholars such as Brenda Gill Plummer and Mary Ditzigat. In other words, as my 16th century book pointed out, when essaying London's invasion of what was termed North Carolina in the 1580s, their first foray into establishing settlements on this continent, this was a class collaboration from the onset, with the elite in London sponsoring a multi-class coalition of settlers, shopkeepers, workers, etc., that ultimately led to depopulation of the indigenous and mass enslavement of the Africans. As we approach 2026, the 250th anniversary of the settlers' revolt that led to the formation of the USA, it needs to be recognized that increasingly there is a stinging Black critique of the origins of this republic, including by the late Tyler Stovall, one of the more garlanded Black scholars of late in his book, White Freedom, the late Charles Mills, formerly of the University of Illinois and Northwestern, and his book, The Racial Contract, Nicole Hannah-Jones of Howard and her best-selling The 1619 Project, Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley and her recently published book, We Refuse, Paramount Black intellectual Ishmael Reed of Oakland, and his slashing spoof of Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton, the Disney-come-Broadway extravaganza celebrated by the Obamas and Cheneys alike. the stunning documentary by Haitian filmmaker Raoul Peck, Exterminate All the Brutes, a profound meditation on various forms of colonialism, including the settler variety. You can still watch it, it's still available. A complement to his earlier worthy dramatization entitled The Young Karl Marx. And of course, my own work, including the counter-revolution of 1776, which underscores a blatant land grab expropriating indigenous nations so as to enhance enslavement of Africans as a driving force for the Republic's creation. Interestingly, although across the political spectrum in this country, there are various critiques of socialism, left, right, and center. Amazingly, there's hardly a critique of republicanism, though it should be clear at this point that anti-monarchy has had substantial difficulty in incorporating any, to use London's old formation, any not of, quote, pure European descent, unquote. The best that can be said in this context is that the construction of whiteness in this republic has been exceedingly capacious, not only incorporating those who have been warring on the shores of Europe, especially Catholic versus Protestant and Christian versus Jewish and English versus Irish and Scots and British versus German, German versus Pole, Pole versus Russian, Serb versus Croat, Italian versus French, but also Christians from beyond the shores of Europe, such as those of Lebanese Christian descent, such as Ralph Nader, and even those of Egyptian Christian origin, African whites, in other words. Excuse my pronunciation. The Hoda Kotb, K-O-T-B, woman on the Today Show, was the comrade of Jenna Bush, the president's daughter. Perhaps understandably, this analysis not only eluded the Panthers, hampering their ability to develop an analysis of capitalism that could undergird armed struggle or radical transformation, but even self-described scientists of society, those who call themselves revolutionaries, who persisted in celebrating slaveholders such as Thomas Jefferson, while somehow neglecting an analysis of settler colonialism. Class collaboration, as noted, inhered in settler colonialism in North America and was epitomized again on January 6, 2021, when a multi-class formation, including CEOs flying in on private jets, shopkeepers, working class military veterans, D-class elements, and the like, descended upon Washington, D.C. in order to prevent a peaceful transfer of power. And of course, we might have a rerun a few months from now in January 2025. Of course, despite contradictions from time to time, such as slave-owning Cherokees, or the reality that the last Confederate general to surrender in June 1865 was a Cherokee, the relations of the unpaid sector of the working class was not always consonant with that of working class settlers who leaned towards expropriation of the indigenous. Whereas more typical of Black people's relationship with the indigenous, I would like to think, was our 19th century alliance with the indigenous of Florida, which led to some of the bloodiest conflicts the United States government was involved in before Vietnam. Moreover, when the Panthers materialized in Algiers in 1971 in search of arms, they were emulating the Colonial Marines and the Carolina Corps, defectors from the unpaid sector of the working class, who about 200 years ago, under the Union Jack, under the British flag, during the War of 1812, routed US forces with some aiding in the burning of the White House in August 1814, sending President James Madison and his garrulous spouse, Dolly, fleeing into the streets, one step ahead of the posse, with many of the liberated Africans. It was estimated that 4,000 Africans were liberated as a result of this conflict. Then boarding British vessels and sailing to freedom in Trinidad and Tobago, where their descendants continued to reside. This tumult is dealt with extensively in my book, Negro Comrades of the Crown, and I'll be elaborating on this topic in a book to be published next year, entitled Slavery's Capital, on slavery in Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia. and perhaps in an envisioned book dealing with Black Canadians. In sum, as my recent work increasingly has stressed, there has been a fundamental mismatch, or contradiction, if you like, in the US working class, with the unpaid sector not only often having interests not in accord with other sectors, but much more prone to engage in class struggle, epitomized by the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, a signal class victory over labor exploitation, prefiguring similar occurrences in the 20th century, versus the class collaboration. January 6, 2021, 1991, Louisiana gubernatorial election, and Teamster leader Sean O'Brien addressing the GOP convention in Milwaukee just a few weeks ago, and other examples too numerous to mention. Thus, the unpaid sector of the working class and their descendants not only aligned with Algeria in 1971, when it was at odds with Washington, and before then with London and indigenous Floridians, then Mexican revolutionaries at the beginning of the 20th century, Japanese nationalists before 1945, then a socialist camp post-1917 to 1991, then bolstered by national liberation movements. The problem, amongst others, as my work on the Red Scare has sought to demonstrate, speaking of the anti-communist upsurge post-1945, including the book at hand, Armed Struggle, is that the trade-off was the clipping of the wings of our most internationalist forces in order to gain anti-Jim Crow, anti-racist concessions. That is to say, the sidelining of the late, great Paul Robeson and his comrade, W.E.B. Du Bois. By the way, I get chills on thinking that I'm now walking on the grounds once trod by Zolanda Robeson when she matriculated at this campus more than a century ago. Then, of course, after the Red Scare and the sidelining of Robeson, Du Bois, Zolanda Robeson et al., there was the battering of the Panthers in the 1960s and the 1970s. That is to say, this dearth of internationalism that we see today, which is afflicting us so tremendously, is not accidental. It has been compelled. This has led to the current political dilemma for both Black Americans and their allies, wherein our leadership and organizations have not necessarily been in the forefront of pressing global concerns, and those that have, such as Congresswoman Cori Bush of St. Louis, defeated because of her support for Palestinian resistance. Millions were spent in order to send her to a crushing defeat. And given the prevalence of class collaboration, this hampers the ability to bolster our global alliances that have been our saving grace historically, which leads us in a very tough position. As the saying goes, class collaboration US style is the highest form of white supremacy, just as white supremacy is the highest form of class collaboration. My book, The Book at Hand, also underscores the violent anti-Jewish bigotry that was prevalent, especially during the time of Earl Warren's tenure as governor of the Golden State in the 1940s to the early 1950s, where he then leapfrogged to become Chief Justice of the United States of America and led the writing of the opinion saying that the US Jim Crow was unconstitutional, believe it or not, circa 1954, which set us into this present era in which we now find ourselves. However, as governor of the Golden State, it was Governor Warren who, of course, led the charge for the internment of Japanese Americans and their property confiscated for no reason other than their happening to be of Japanese ancestry. You may want to ponder why German Americans and Italian Americans were not treated similarly. And of course, it was Governor Warren who was in power when you had the relentless fly-specking of Jewish Americans, especially Jewish American communists. A turning point for that group comes not only with the 1953 execution of the Jewish communist Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, supposedly for passing to Moscow the alleged purported secret, quote unquote, of atomic bombs, but also a few years later when Israel, by the way, there was a split in the international radical movement 1947, 1948, about the viability of whether or not the creation of the State of Israel should be supported. But a few years later, in 1956, Israel was simultaneously involved with France and Britain in the attack on Nasser's Egypt, the consequences of which transformed for decades the foreign policies of Britain and France, and Israel was also involved that same year in the transmission of revelations about the misdeeds of Soviet leader Joseph Stalin, recently passed away, whose picture, by the way, graced the wall of Panther leader Eldridge Cleaver's office in San Francisco. The constellation of these forces served to drive numerous Jewish Americans from the organized left, as it weakened the organized left, which too created a vacuum in the struggle for socialism, opening a door for the rise of the Panthers. The internationalism of the Panthers was an outgrowth of their positioning as a halfway house between black nationalism and the struggle for socialism. The latter is reflected in the fact that the precocious teenager with the two long arms, two long weapons, who graces the cover of my book, Jonathan Jackson, 17 years old at the time, who led the assault on the Marin County Courthouse in August 1970, ostensibly to free his older brother, George Jackson, from prison. As a student at Pasadena High School in Southern California, he edited a newsletter, Iskra, homage to the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, which had a publication of the same name. Of course, his brother George Jackson, before his tragic slaying a year later, stated that the central element of his mission was to give the struggle for socialism a black face. I recall from our political education classes in the Bay Area, believe it or not, I was living out there in 1970. Part of the syllabus was not only Russian radicals like Plekhanov, but we were also deeply influenced by the British Marxists, including Carnforth, Dutt, Wattis, Pomeroy. Indeed, there is a through line in this stretching back two centuries to the correspondence between Paramount leader Henri Christophe, Haitian leader Henri Christophe, and British abolitionist Thomas Clarkson. Their correspondence has been published. It's still worth reading. And the companion reality that black abolitionists such as Frederick Douglass were similarly shaped by their British counterparts in the 1840s. To the late, great Paul Robeson confiding that in order to understand his turn towards socialism, one should look to his almost two-decade exile in London, as much as his fluency in the Russian language, being influenced by the aforementioned Cornforth, Dutt, Wattis, the British radical tradition. We also read Rosa Luxemburg and Clara Zetkin and Claudia Jones and Cabral and Fanon, Govan Mbeki, father of second South African President Thabo Mbeki, a frequent foil of Mandela, during their joint tenure and imprisonment on Robben Island. I mentioned in this book that while teaching in Vacaville Prison during my early years in Berkeley, I lent my prized copy of the book by Frederick Engels, The Origins of the Family, Private Property, and the State, to an inmate then known as Donald DeFries, soon to gain notoriety for his accused role in the kidnapping of newspaper heiress Patty Hearst. Of course, he went up in flames in the early 1970s as a result of a shootout with the LAPD and his leadership of the Symbionese Liberation Army. Of course, my book was never returned. A lesson about lending out books. I note this to suggest that the current historiography of black power, which groups the Black Panthers within this rubric, though the leaders themselves, as the book suggests, did not see themselves in that way. Future studies on Black power should engage in reformulation and take note of the reality noted above. The intra-class mismatch, as now analyzed, as noted by Roscoe Proctor, also contributed to one of the more significant theoretical deviations by the Panthers, the positing of the lumpen as the motive force in their revolutionary movement. They adapted this apparently from a book by Karl Marx, The 18th Brumaire. In the reader that Eric mentioned, I have a lengthier analysis of this question of the lumpen. But suffice it to say that in some ways, their attraction to the lumpen was propelled in no small measure by their lack of confidence in the US working class, for reasons already alluded to, because they conflated the lumpen with the unemployed, when actually it would be more precise to conflate the lumpen with either large organized crime families or smaller lumpen, such as drug dealers. And of course, this also led to one of their most significant mistakes, that is to say, the elevation of pimping, which is now a part of the vocabulary in this country, doing heavy work as noun, verb, and adjective. And of course, it has not been helpful in the struggle against male supremacy, to put it mildly. And this tendency is also reflected culturally in certain forms of popular music. This trend also reflects the peculiar culture of the Southland, Southern California, as noted. After the destruction of the Panthers, filling a vacuum where street organizations, often paramilitary in character, denoted as gangs, they were a response to the extraordinary explosion, not only of police terror by the notorious LAPD, but also a phenomenon that either myself or one of you should write about. And that is the systematic use of arson to engage in what could euphemistically be called aggressive gentrification. That is to say, burning out Black families systematically from neighborhoods so that they would be forced to move. This was a routine part of the landscape in the Southland. In fact, if you look at certain parts of Palm Springs, now a redoubt for fading movie stars and former US presidents, where they're residing used to be the site of a Black community before they were driven out. In other words, in assessing why at a certain point some African Americans found it necessary to pick up the gun, one should look not only at police terror, but other forms of terror, such as arson, for example. Of course, families would oftentimes go up in flames in their homes as a result of arson. Speaking of the Southland, one cannot separate the fact that Los Angeles was a bastion for not only the Panthers and the Communists, but also the NAACP, the oldest human rights organization, founded in 1909, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. All of these aforementioned organizations relied heavily upon substantial donations from Hollywood. The Screenwriters Guild, founded by the communist leader John Howard Lawson, whose book, The Hidden Heritage, I continue to recommend, and his comrade Dalton Trumbo, perhaps the most talented screenwriter this country has produced to this point. I still recommend the screenplay To Spartacus, starring Kirk Douglas, which you should add to your cinematic list. Trumbo went on to fund the Panthers, and he helped to bail out Angela Davis, the University of California professor, accused because of her assumed role in aiding Jonathan Jackson and the shootout that led to the killing of a judge. He helped to bail her out when she faced a fraught moment during her trial that could have led to her execution. As the Apple TV movie recently exhibited, The Big Cigar, indicated, the Panthers were also subsidized by Bert Schneider, a producer whose credits included Easy Rider, a major grossing film, as also the Jack Nicholson vehicle Five Easy Pieces. As for the NAACP, their vaunted Beverly Hills Hollywood branch remained as a cash cow, with their fundraisers today, as you probably know, televised, featuring tuxedoed and elegantly gowned black stars. Unfortunately for the left, given the rise of a competitive film industry in China, not to mention analogs such as Bollywood in India, Nollywood in Nigeria, along with the concomitant challenges of artificial intelligence, it is doubtful if the entertainment industry will have the wherewithal to subsidize the left as it has done historically. One unfortunate ongoing legacy that I have noticed, and I hope I'm not being an old fogey by saying this, is that some of our younger comrades expect elders like myself to emulate Kendrick Lamar and treat peers as if they're Drake in issuing the equivalent of diss tracks. In other words, I notice this tendency of some of our younger comrades, they're very much into beefing, seeking to show he's the sellout, I'm the revolutionary, as opposed to maybe Kendrick Lamar joining hands with Drake and challenging the industry for redistribution of the wealth. I mean, that's what I would tell them. Of course, a turning point in our movement took place 75-odd years ago when the NAACP broke with the internationalist tradition of the black movement, stretching back to our alliance with London, and before that with Spain, for example, and tossed overboard its founder, Du Bois, along with Robeson and their comrades in return for anti-Jim Crow concessions, concessions which are now on the chopping block, as reflected in the figures trickling in about the reduction of black admission to entering universities and colleges, including this one too, if I'm not mistaken. Also worth considering is the proximity of Mexico in this book, whose influence on neighboring San Diego, dandy San Diego, sketched in the book, especially its opposition from the self-described Mexico's opposition to San Diego seeking to export Jim Crow. That is to say, when some of the San Diego reactionaries would travel across the border, they would expect the Mexicans to observe Jim Crow. And when the Mexicans did not, that would lead to international incidents. The Panthers sought to fill this vacuum, and certainly their legation in Algiers was a political and diplomatic breakthrough, not to mention their delegations to Congo Brazzaville, fraternal ties to the Palestinian Liberation Organization, solidarity with Vietnam, etc. However, like many in the United States left, they misinterpreted the potent triangular relationship between China, the United States, and the then Soviet Union, seeing the latter two as collaborating against the former, which hampered their ties to what should have been its diplomatic priority, speaking of Cuba, which of course was closely tied to Moscow. I speculate in the book that the Panthers might have seen China as a replay of pre-1945 Japan, when it styled itself as the champion of the colored races, so-called, and as noted, gathered support in this part of the country. This powerful tie is yet to dissipate, in that the Wu-Tang Clan is only one of a number of entities that continues to tout the idea of the so-called Asiatic black man, although I'm not sure if they know where it comes from. a legacy of the pre-1945 era. We now know that the U.S. alliance with Maoist China may have been one of the most significant diplomatic blunders in world history, executed by Washington. I analogize it to the ties between a good deal of the Islamic world and Protestant London in the 1500s against the interests of His Catholic Majesty in Spain, which sheds light on why we are now sighted in North America speaking English, as opposed to not being here at all or speaking Spanish, for example. Because we now know that Beijing is in the passing lane, presenting a formidable 21st century challenge for U.S. imperialism. I go in this vein for a few pages, which I'll spare you, about various blunders diplomatically of the Panthers and their allies. But I will say this, another note to graduate students or perhaps younger scholars. At George Washington University in Washington, D.C., there's a huge archive of a former black CIA operative by the name of Richard Gibson. You'll find in that archive voluminous correspondence with many black nationalists, which I think you'll find illuminating and certainly could produce a worthy book. In any case, let me conclude by saying that going forward in this century, we need more serious thinking about some of the aforementioned subjects that I have mentioned. Class collaboration, the deficit in internationalism, settler colonialism, the impact of the rise of China, the underlying causes of anti-blackness, or to put it another way, we need to erode and or remove the horrific conditions that impelled Panthers in 1971 to wind up in Algeria negotiating for arms. Because if we do not erode and or remove these underlying conditions, you will see future generations of younger black Americans going abroad to negotiate for arms in order to forcibly remove the underlying conditions that drove them to this point. Thank you for your attention. So,
thank you, Dr. Horn, for your very powerful talk. We've got plenty of time for questions, comments, responses. We ask that if you have a question or comment that you keep it succinct, if possible, if you can identify yourself. So please, the floor is open. Questions, comments, points of clarification.
I could go on reading pages that I skipped over.
There's a question in the back.
Hello, Dr. Horn. Thank you for coming here. It's truly an honor to meet you. I've heard a lot of your lectures online. This is my first time being able to actually see you, so thank you. As someone that was, I'm from the Midwest, but has spent over 30 years in California, 20 of them in Northern California. Do you feel that the situations that are happening, like in Oakland, as we speak right now, and with black people within the state, as in they had the that AB Bill 1840, where they were actually going to give money to people who weren't citizens, but at the same time, they weren't bringing up something that could have given reparations to citizens who had been historically discriminated. Do you see all of this? Forgive me, I'm giving a little bit of a wide question, but do you see the cyclical manner, I guess, with a lot of it?
Well, thank you for your question. Since you've lived in Northern California, for those of you who may not be familiar, although what I'm about to say could be said for many black communities, the black folks in California are not doing very well, I mean, generally speaking. Housing costs are unsustainable. Even though it has a large population numerically, their percentage is dropping. And my study only goes up, as the title suggests, through the 70s. But if someone were to do a study of California from the 70s to the present, inevitably they'd focus, I would think, on the prison industrial complex and the spectacular incarceration of black men, increasingly black women. The milder forms of gentrification, I say milder because to the best of my knowledge, it doesn't involve arson, burning people out to force them to move. They're more impersonal forces causing gentrification. But again, I would say that, as they say in the law oftentimes, this is not an act of God, so to speak. I mean, this is a product of political forces, wrong political choices, compromises made by the NAACP in the 1950s, which cut us off from a global community. I mean, for example, the reparations bill that you mentioned, I still don't understand how in a political context in the United States, where, as noted, there's an attack on affirmative action, DEI has become a slur, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and yet there's an apparent feeling that reparations can be accomplished without internationalizing the question. I don't understand how domestic forces who are sufficiently powerful to circumscribe affirmative action, to turn DEI into a slur, or somehow they're going to acquiesce to reparations for enslavement, particularly when the line, as you probably know, on enslavement in this country was that the Civil War solved that. 600,000 people died. What more do you want? Or to go back further, the line is that actually 1776 was abolitionist, even though the number of enslaved Africans increased exponentially post-1776 from thousands to millions. So once again, I mean, to put it caustically, I think black Americans, not only in California, but generally, are engaged in a very dangerous experiment, which is that survival will take place absent political acuity, absent adroit political strategizing, absent internationalism. That's a very dangerous experiment, and I think that we're seeing the inevitable diabolical results as we speak.
Thank you.
Junaid Rana, Department of Asian American Studies. Thank you. I have not met you before either. I'm a huge fan. I've got at least 20 of the books that you mentioned in your talk. I wanted to pick up on the point around internationalism. I absolutely agree with you around the point of social movements needing to internationalize, and that can be their success or failure. So I'm curious how you would comment on the last 6 months of international solidarity that we saw on a lot of college campuses regarding Gaza and Palestine. Do you think that, how does this fit with the argument around internationalism? Has something changed around internationalism in terms of the strategy itself? Does it look different now? I think that's also what I'm thinking in my head. So I'm just curious about your thoughts.
Well, first of all, to state the obvious, these campus protests were propelled by an issue external, in a sense, to the United States of America, although we all know about U.S. funding for Israel. And as I said in my remarks, it's had domestic consequence, not only in terms of the reanimation of the concept of settler colonialism, which is now part of the discourse in this country, leading, I think, to a shot in the arm for the indigenous rights movement in this country, for example. And so I think that that illustrates one of the themes of my remarks, which is that the indigenous rights movement in this country has received a shot in the arm from internationalism, albeit internationalism involving historic Palestine. But as Professor McDuffie said, we shouldn't count our chickens before the eggs are hatched, because as one can expect in a country such as this one, there's been a furious counter-reaction to these protests. I found it striking that the president of Columbia University, where a lot of this was kicked off, she not only resigned after 10 months, but left the country. I think that she might be trying to tell us something. So I think the victories of this movement notwithstanding, I understand that Northwestern, your neighbor, that a compromise agreement was reached where they're going to fund the education of a number of Palestinian students, if I'm not mistaken, at Brown University. They're going to have a vote on divestment. And divestment, of course, that is to say, divesting endowments from corporations that somehow are invested in arming Israel, for example. So I guess I have a Janus-faced response to your question. That is to say, on the one hand, I think this movement has been quite significant. But on the other hand, the last chapter has not been written. And it would be premature to declare victory. I mean, as they say in the United States, spike the football at the 10-yard line. I mean, that would be a gross political blunder.
There's a question up front and perhaps more questions.
Good evening, Dr. Horn. My name is Kamal Rashid. I'm a professor at Northeastern Illinois University. I'm also a graduate of U of I. Richard Benson told me you were going to be here, so I drove down for it. So good to meet you in the flesh. My question was related to not just the local and temporal context that you write about in the book, but this theme of internationalism among Black folks generally. And I don't know why I didn't think about this until just now, but I should have. But obviously, when you look at Black struggles, particularly in the 18th and 19th century, especially the 19th century after the context of the Haitian Revolution, there's a Pan-African and internationalist character to resistance throughout the diaspora. Interestingly enough, by the time you get to the early 20th century, you know, as you mentioned, Paul Robeson and Du Bois are the most clear expressions of this, but by the time you get to the middle of the 20th century, before the Panthers, you get Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. So it made me wonder, relative to this idea, I'm starting to wonder now if the final flowering of this, as it were, in the 20th century was really in hip-hop. And you mentioned, you know, hip-hop music earlier, and it brought to mind Rakim. He came out with a song in the early 90s, Casualties of War. It was about the U.S. war in Iraq. There was another song by a Chicago rapper who went to law school here, Capital D from the Crew All Natural. He came out with a song called Start the Revolution. I actually published a paper with that in the title. And in each of those pieces, they advocate internationalism, but it's framed within the context of Islam or a type of quasi-Islam, given, you know, what Rakim's orientation is with regards to the 5% nation. And it, to me, begs the question, indeed, there's a type of, a type of provincialism which has emerged in Black political thought, which is eschewed radicalism as an orientation towards resistance, that makes me wonder if, with regards to the reemergence of internationalist sentiments among Black radicals in the future and the shifting ideological orientations that it takes from the 18th century to the present, what form you think that might look like in the future?
Well, I'll give a cynical response and then say something more substantive. Objection, Your Honor, the question calls for speculation. certainly, one of the points I make in this book is that you can not ignore the fact that post-1945, there has been an exponential increase in the allure of Islam amongst many Black Americans. Of course, It has roots pre-1945. Indeed, certain scholars have suggested that if you look at the African slave trade, that a significant number of the enslaved came to North America as Muslims. And of course, you've had the uncovering of writings in the Arabic script, particularly in North Carolina, from the days of slavery. As a matter of fact, Rihanna Gittens, the prize-winning composer, has done an opera based upon one of these enslaved Africans who was writing an Arabic script. I would also say that there tends to be a seesaw in movements. That is to say that as, I don't find it coincidental, that as the socialist left began to decline, that Islam gained in popularity. Because I think that many Black Americans were looking to latch on to some sort of international force. Islam was certainly an international force. Once again, it bespeaks, I think, their lack of confidence in a purely domestic strategy. So I would imagine that that trend is going to continue. Part of what I skipped over in my prepared remarks was precisely on this question. Part of what I skipped over is the fact of something I'm sure you're all familiar with since you're due south of Chicago, that is to say the Nation of Islam, headquartered in Chicago. And I mentioned it's sort of a paradox. I mean, if you look at their newspaper, The Final Call, it has substantial international news. But as a person who's oftentimes quoted in The Final Call, I find it striking and remarkable that the people who are quoted are oftentimes people of the left, such as myself. And in fact, its predecessor organ, Muhammad Speaks, if you go back and look at some of their issues from the early 1970s, you'll find articles by myself. As a matter of fact, as I skipped over, a number of leaders of Muhammad Speaks were actually people of the left, including the chief editor, the late Joe Walker. I mentioned in the excluded remarks, John Woodford, still in the land of the living in Ann Arbor, Michigan, just outside of Detroit. Somebody should interview him about his association with Muhammad Speaks. And of course, also his journeys to pre-1979 Afghanistan and covering the war in Afghanistan post-1979 when the United States got heavily involved, leading to this outrage today, in today's Afghanistan, where it's the most blatant form of gender apartheid on planet Earth, which is a complete and total turnabout, as John Woodford could tell you, about what formerly transpired in Afghanistan before all of this external interference. So I would just say in summary that going forward, I expect, unless I'm missing something, I expect internationalism in the Black community, to the extent that it arises, to proceed on these dual tracks. That is to say, a certain kind of socialist-oriented track and a certain kind of Islamic-oriented track. And I think that one of our challenges is to somehow find the intelligence to avoid beefing, for lack of a better word.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. I'm Maryam Kashani in Gender and Women's Studies and Asian American Studies. I kind of wrote a book about your answer to the last question. But I guess my question is, because of the research I did for my book, a lot of Black Panthers who became Muslim, and my book's about Northern California, I'd really love to hear you talk more about the question mark in your title. I'm assuming it's in the book, but I'd really love to hear you talk about it. Yeah.
Well, in the book, I also allude to the fact that a number of the Black Panther leaders, their fathers were Christian pastors, and B, a number of those who left the Black Panther Party and are still active are now Christian pastors, particularly in the Southland, with their leading flocks. for example. With regard to the question mark is it's doing a lot of work. I mean, I'm sort of asking a question. I also have the question mark because the book, as anyone who's looked at it will acknowledge, doesn't wholly and exclusively deal with the question of armed struggle. I mean, in my excluded remarks, I talk about the distinction between amongst armed propaganda, such as the Panthers invading the Sacramento legislature in May 1967, armed self-defense, which of course Malcolm X talked about, and the Panthers exhibited in December 1969 when they fought back against a raid on their headquarters, and then armed struggle, which was not necessarily the leading factor in terms of their political struggles. So the question mark is also hopefully meant to get the potential reader to recognize that this is still a question. Because, as I point out in the book, if you look at slavery, I mean, there was John Brown's raid in October 1859 in Western Virginia. There was Nat Turner's revolt in August 1831. There was the Haitian Revolution. In an oft-neglected episode in the 1920s, there was Dr. Sweet of Detroit, who fought back with arms in hand against a home invasion. That's another form of terror that I could have gone into, home invasions, which led directly to the formation of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, which is still with us. So the question mark is there for a number of reasons.
Hi, my name is Akuya Nkansa Mankra. I am a grad student at UIC. I have a couple of questions. So I really appreciate what you were saying about NAACP. I Googled it while you were talking. Apparently there were 60 founders, seven of whom were African-American. And you were mentioning that there was a shift, it seems like a shift in leadership in terms of certain people being pushed out of the organization. And so I'm curious about what you've learned in regards to who was pushed out, and I guess like the shifts in NAACP's dynamics. My second question is around Huey P. Newton in terms of, you know, recently I've been trying to engage with his work, and something that I find really remarkable is his framework of reactionary intercommunalism versus revolutionary intercommunalism. I think the reactionary intercommunalism has been useful for understanding, you know, the standing of the U.S. as a global power. And so I'm curious about your perspective on his framework of revolutionary intercommunalism in regards to this call that you're making around having a more internationalist lens in the U.S.
Well, with regard to your first question, so the NAACP was compelled to engage in a purge. W.E.B. Du Bois, in the first instance, who had returned to the organization in 1944, when the NAACP was in a different political climate given the anti-fascist war, and he was going to be a director of foreign relations, but by 1948, the political climate had changed, and the kind of struggle that he had envisioned in league with national liberation movements and the socialist camp was no longer on the table, because the NAACP was induced to throw him overboard, to throw overboard other people of that ilk. Although, as I point out in the book, there were certain chapters that did not go along, like the San Francisco chapter, led by Dr. Carlton Goodlett, a name we should recall fondly, who was a leader of the NAACP chapter in San Francisco, cooperated with the left, was a leader in the international peace movement, and somehow managed to survive in the organization, which is quite astonishing. So in sum and in short, any who were left of liberal were thrown overboard. The problem, as I point out, is that those who were left of liberal were sort of a shield for the liberals. I point out that when the Panthers were in their heyday, there were more funds coming into the coffers of the NAACP because there were those who felt that if they could be bulwarked and bolstered, there would be no need for the Panthers. Then, of course, after they were liquidated, there were fewer donations coming to the NAACP. So what they were doing was not in their self-interest. Now, with regard to Huey P. Newton, also a son of a pastor, a Christian pastor, I do agree that his concepts of revolutionary intercommunalism was a way to put his brand on a long-term trend, which is internationalism. And I bear him no grudges for inventing a term to which he can attach his own name, because as the saying goes, a rose by any other name is just as sweet.
All right, thank you. Folks, we've got about 10 more minutes. So I think what we'll do is maybe we'll take a couple questions at a time. Again, we definitely want to hear from as many people as possible, certainly students. And certainly we have some of my undergraduate students here, so we might ask you to speak. But folks, again, questions. We'll take a few questions at a time.
Great to meet you, Dr. Horn. My name is Tafari Melisizwe. I'm a cultural worker, photographer, and educator based in Chicago. Trending in this line of internationalism, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the life and work of Paulu Kamarakafego and Kito Swan's book, Paulu's Diaspora, because I think that his work in recovery there, I think, is a great person to be in conversation with around all these kind of continuing lines and legacies. So if you could share anything on Paulu, that'd be fantastic.
Question about Kito Swan's book.
Hello, my name is James Kilgore. I formerly taught at the university. I work in the community with First Followers, which is an organization of formerly incarcerated folks. But over the course of my years from the time I lived in Oakland in 1970, like yourself, I've done a lot of work with solidarity movements for the liberation movements in Southern Africa in particular, but other parts of the world. And I'm wondering, given the title of your book, I'm wondering kind of what's, it's kind of a broad question, but what's your kind of assessment of armed struggle as a political strategy? Because we've seen places like Zimbabwe, like South Africa, where armed struggle has maybe not given us all the results we were hoping for in the solidarity movement. And do you see that as a pathway for the future? Is there a critique of it? I know that's not the subject of your book, but I know you know the whole world, really.
I would only, in response to your question, recommend Kito Swan's book, which, if you're not familiar, deals with sort of a new area of interest in the sprawling field of Black studies, that is to say, Black Pacific. And I tried to make an early contribution to this field by writing a book called The White Pacific, which deals with Fiji, deals with Hawaii pre the US takeover, deals with the post 1865 slave trade, to be blunt, in Melanesians and Polynesians being dispatched to Queensland, Australia to work in agriculture, not unlike the ancestors of some of us. And so now, there is increasing interest. Because, of course, when I went to Fiji, one of the things I found out was that the indigenous Fijians, who, lack of a better way to put it, resemble a person like myself. As a matter of fact, when I was there, I noticed that the women were wearing their hair, as they say, en naturel. And I was thinking, Chicago. So somebody should tell Johnson Products in Chicago. Women wearing their hair naturally. Do a marketing and advertising campaign, get them all the straight hair, make a mint. But I say that seriously because, you know, there's a distinct resemblance, and I found that the indigenous Fijian language has a number of words, linguistics, that are similar to certain East African languages, suggesting
Of course, we necessarily have to go to archives to try to make historical beliefs and conclusions, suggesting that there was some sort of a transmission across the ocean at a certain point from East Africa to Fiji. So Kito's book, Kito Swan's book, deals with the Black Pacific. There's a book coming out by Guy Emerson Mount that also deals with the Black Pacific. I'm working on a book now on a similar subject, dealing once again with Hawaii, which, by the way, has great archives, especially diplomatic archives. They, before the U.S. takeover, they had embassies and legations all over the world. So, you know, Black Pacific is really an up-and-coming field that I highly recommend. Now, with regard to your question, I mean, I think it depends. I mean, you know, a lot of people in this country have been writing about impending fascism. Madeleine Albright, the late Secretary of State, one of her final books was Fascism and Warning. Jason Stanley at Yale has done a number of books warning about impending fascism. You don't have to be an oracle to suspect that they may be onto something. And in case that happens, inevitably it seems to me that the question of armed struggle will arise. I mean, it's not because of me, it's because people will be responding to their objective conditions. I mean, people who respond to the hot breath of fascism. And as I also suggest, that if they do tend to go down that rocky road, they may want to avoid some of the errors of the past. For example, alienating the Cubans, to begin with, not having sufficient ties with the movement in Quebec, which could have been very supportive, and had been supportive during the days of slavery. And that's the problem with not necessarily being aware of history. It may not guide you to the present and future if you're not aware of what happened in the past.
And I think there was a hand over here. Was it Cam? And Cam, we might let this be the last question. We'll see.
Professor Horn, thank you. Thank you so much for your lecture. It was really informative. My name is Cam. I'm a graduate student, very humbly advised by Professor McDuffie. You said something really fascinating about white supremacy being the highest form of class collaboration. I would really, really appreciate you expounding on that.
Well, it goes back to what I was saying about the first London foray. It is the first London foray, and to try to set up settlements in the 1580s in North Carolina. As I talk about in my book, Dawn of the Apocalypse, which goes to the 16th century, it was a class collaboration enterprise from the inception. That is to say, one is in London sponsoring this multi-class formation with dual goal, with the initial goal of taking land from the indigenous and from that small acorn mighty oak grew, whereby the land then was taken progressively across the continent. I mentioned another one, it might have been number one, Texas, that if you look at the removal of the euphemism of the Native Americans in the 1820s from the Southeast Quadrant in North America, for example, the state of Georgia, where the Cherokees oftentimes collaborated with the settlers. I mean, they enslaved Africans, they converted to Christianity, they engaged in sedentary agricultural suits, they developed an alphabet, published newspapers, bilingual newspapers, which can still use for research. They still had to go. And of course, oftentimes you had figuratively fresh off the boat, were able to move into mansions. And so, previously occupied by Cherokees. And as I said in my remarks, I believe the one who was fighting for the Confederacy. The last Confederate general to surrender was a Cherokee. And if you look at the state of Oklahoma, because part of the process, part of the project, was for the indigenous Southeast Quadrant to move to what was called Indian Territory. Actually, this is still within my text. Because on one hand, putting the indigenous just north of the Republic of Texas secedes from Mexico in 1836, they begin to challenge the United States, particularly in the field of slavery. It's an independent country. And so the United States does a checkmate on putting disgruntled Native Americans on the border. And Texas eventually joins the Union, although Texas is now taught once again as a secede of the United States. Yeah, story of an independent country. In case they do, keep the light on for you. But what you'll find in the state of Oklahoma, because Oklahoma then emerges, although it's supposed to be this battle stand for the indigenous, for as long as the rational world and the river shall flow. But then the settlers said, well, you know what, I think we want Indian territory too. So that was what we did. You're probably familiar with the Oklahoma University football team called the Sooners. You know, part of the term Sooners is that they have a language for Native American and, of course, multi-class Europeans can get in round four by seizing the Native American land. This is 1889. And the Sooners were one of those who jumped the gun to go claim the land that was supposed to be the land of the Native Americans as long as the river shall flow and the grass shall grow. And so then, after the land was seized, you had Oklahoma enter the Union in 1907, of course. One of the first pieces of legislation taken up by the legislature was the Jim Crow law. And interestingly about the Jim Crow law, and this is something people need to ponder. A lot of these Jim Crow laws, they focused on black people with surgical precision, not only because of anti-blackness, but also, I would argue, because of furor that billions of dollars in investment being lost when slavery was abolished without compensation. Oftentimes when I do this in my class, I'll go to a student, because you know, students, they're fiddling with their smartphones, like the teacher, right? Putting the tail of the Swift video, etc. So I'll snatch the smartphone and I'm just taking your property without compensation. Right. You're furious, aren't you? You want to take me outside and thrash me, I'm sure. That's how the slave owners felt in 1865, when their property was taken without compensation. So, in some of the substance, there were many Europeans across class lines who did enjoy the so-called American dream. They were able to get Native American land. I mean, I don't think you can begin to understand the 75 million voted for Trump in 2020, perhaps a larger number in a few weeks, and perhaps bum-rushing the Capitol in January 2025, without understanding this backstory. Because there were some people who did that. And not to mention the process whereby those who were not allowed to benefit were subjugated, which has enormous political and psychological impact.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Horn.
We state these facts only to let you know that those of us who are revolutionary, Pan-Africanists, is not because we love revolution. It is historically determined, and we have no alternative but to follow history and to use history for the benefit of our people.